So again, good morning, everyone. It's nice in the beginning. You don't have to do it for the whole talk, but if everybody could turn on their video, so as if we were all in the hall, at least we could see each other, even though we are mostly just little squares. So if everybody could just for a moment turn on their video, that would be wonderful. And also today we have a projector in the back of the hall that is putting up the Zoom screens. So it enables me to see who I'm talking to, which is I enjoy very much. So you can scroll through your various Zoom windows. Left to right, right to left. So good, thank you. Like many of you, these last days, we've been very aware of fire. And we've been very aware of the destructive power of fire, especially when it has substances that are readily and easily combustible. As well as we are aware, beside the destructive force of fire, we are aware of suffering that it is causing many people. Fear, loss, sadness, despair, maybe for some anger. And so, while there are many things that could be said, what really came to mind, of course, is there are several significant places that fire is used within the Buddhist teachings. And I just want to use them today to kind of look at fire and the meaning of fire, perhaps in a different way. There is a, probably the most well-known reference to fire is, there is a, in the Pali Canon, there is a fire sermon. And relates to how sort of the Buddha converted an ascetic named Kashyapa, who became one of his main disciples, who was quite famous and well-known, had hundreds if not thousands of students. And he was his practice was the worship of fire, the deity Agni, who's still today within the Hindu pantheon. And, you know, their practice was the worship of fire, the power of fire. And the Buddha, at the end of this not too long sutta, the Buddha talked to Kashyapa and his followers. And what he gave them was known as this fire sermon, where he looked at fire in a different way than the physical way or the energetic way that the Kashyapas were teaching. And now this is just from the end of it. And again, I'm not going to focus this on today, but it says, the Blessed One, the Buddha, seeing the Jatilas of Nadi and Gaya, these were all the followers, Nadi and Gaya's or places, who had practiced severe austerities and worshiped fire, were now come to him. He preached a sermon on fire and said, everything is burning. All senses are burning. Thoughts are burning. They are burning with the fire of desire and greed, the fire of anger, the fire of ignorance, the fire of hatred. And as long as the fire finds flammable things upon which it can feed, so long will it burn. And then there will be birth and death, decay, grief, lamentation, suffering, despair, and sorrow. Considering this, a disciple of the Dharma will see the Four Noble Truths and walk in the Eightfold Path of Righteousness. He or she will become wary of their senses, wary of their thoughts. They will divest themselves of greed and grasping and attachment to become free. They will be delivered from selfishness and attain the blessed state of nirvana. So in this one, he's using a fire, something that is hot, something that burns, and something that destroys. In relationship to really our experience as human beings, our sensory experience, our mental experience, our emotional experience. He's saying these things are on fire. They're on fire with these emotional afflictions, with these wrong views, and therefore they're always kind of burning. And so, is that true? You know, is our mind on fire from time to time? They may not be raging forest fires. They may be small fires that are burning, that we cannot see or hear or smell or taste or feel without some kind of emotional response, some kind of emotional reaction, some kind of agitation, some sort of grasping, some sort of aversion, some sort of attachment. And especially in relationship to our thoughts and the kind of thoughts we have. Do our thoughts, are they like a fire that kind of burns through us? And so the Buddha is using fire as a metaphor here, to have us look at our human experience and to see whether, you know, the fires of affliction, the fires of suffering, the fires of ignorance and delusion are not feeding on our just very normal and natural sensory experience, mental experience. Are we cool? Or are we hot and burning? So anyhow, that's the fire sermon. You can look it up. But what I wanted to mostly focus on are two others. One is another probably very well-known parable, the parable of the burning house. And then a much smaller, less known writing about fire. From the great Japanese Zen teacher Hakuin, who lived in the 17th, 18th century. So I am reading from the Lotus Sutra is one of the great Mahayana Buddhist sutras. And there is a chapter in it called Parable. And I will be reading, but also a little paraphrasing so that we can talk about it. And the Buddha, sort of in the paragraph before, he talks about why he uses parables and other kinds of phrases. He says, these are just expedient devices that I use to teach the Dharma, and they only have one purpose: to help beings realize perfect enlightenment. And he's talking to Sariputra, one of his main disciples, and he said, let me give you an example how I teach through the use of parables. And he says, and they who have intelligence gain understanding through parables. And so then he tells a story. He tells a story of a wealthy man who has great power, who's getting on in years, who has a lot of wealth, and et cetera. He has a great house, except his house only has one doorway. But hundreds of people, you know, a lot of his family and hundreds of people live in this house. But he says this is an old house, and a lot of things are rotting, and some of the walls are crumbling, and the pillars are decayed, and things are a little tipped. He says, all of a sudden, a fire breaks out in the house. And beside these hundreds of people, many of them who are adults can take care of himself, he realizes, I guess he had many children, 10, 20, 30 of them, are still in the house. So when he sees this fire break out in the house, it says he's alarmed. He's terrified. And he says, how am I going to get my kids out so they're not burned up? Because there's only one doorway, and it is beginning to burn. The fire, he says, is coming to press on them. They will die. And then he says, but they don't seem to be horrified. They don't seem to have any wish to leave. You know why? Because they are so consumed with their games, their children. They're so consumed with their games. So they are unaware, ignorant, unperturbed, and unafraid. The man thinks, well, I am one person. I mean, I am strong. I could go in there and maybe rescue a few children of mine, but the door is very narrow. And my children, as yet young and having no understanding, are in love with their playthings. So I must go in there very quickly and explain to them the terror of what's going on. I mustn't let this fire burn them to death. So he goes in there and he goes to his children who are all in their playroom, and he says to them, get out quickly. He urges them with very explicit words, but the children are still attached to their game. And when he talked to them about the danger in the fire, they kind of look up and they really don't get it. They don't believe him. They don't accept what he says, that they're really in danger and there's a fire raging. They are totally unalarmed and unafraid, and they have no intention of leaving. They really can't even conceive of what a fire, house, they're going to lose everything. You know, they sort of just continue on and sort of look blankly at their father. Now, this great man, he had a thought. This house is burning up. If I can't get them out in time, the children will be burnt. I know I will use an expedient to get them out, to escape this disaster. Now, he knows he knows his children, and that each child, has preferences, but all their preferences are for playthings. So attached to their toys that they are. So what he does, and I'll just, So what he does, he uses an expedient way to save them, to get their attention. He says to them, kids, quickly come outside. I have these incredible things. I have all these different kinds of carts that are all of different designs, and there are all these different animals pulling them. Come out quickly, come out quickly. Now this, the children respond to, right? And so they all come running out. And therefore, he has saved his children by telling them a story. This is very powerful. Telling them a story that they can get that will motivate them. Because they do not see what's going on around. And actually, really this has a lot to do with different Buddhist teachings and really the idea that somehow within the Buddhist framework, the Buddha teaches many ways of getting people like us to leave our playthings, to pay attention to what's going on around us. Basically see the danger we are in. And so actually all the various playthings that he talks to them about, these different kinds of carts and different kind of animals, are all representative of various Buddhist paths that he teaches, right? So if we took our modern day, we might say, oh, you know, you're suffering from stress. Here, I have some mindfulness for you. Oh, okay. I'll pay attention to that. For others, they may say, well, I have some, it's like we could say this is not quite Buddhism, but it could be like saying a teacher goes, oh, you know, if you stay here, you're going to burn like in hell, right? So come with me. I have heaven for you. And so, you know, sentient beings, they'll pay attention to that. Otherwise, they'll keep on their way. But when they find out, oh, if they keep doing what they're doing, they're going to go to hell and suffer, but there's another way I can get you to heaven, that gets them out. And so the Buddha has many, many teachings to help attract sentient beings where they're at, get them to pay attention so they can get out of their suffering. And what the Buddha says is what he's talking about is, in this one, he's talking about impermanence. As opposed to the other, in the other sutta, it was more talking about kind of the fieriness, the burning of the senses and the mind that is always agitated, attachment, aversion. Here the Buddha is talking about, with the house, he's talking about, you know, this house that is falling down, this house that is impermanent, right? And that the raging fire is the fire that burns. It is the fire of impermanence. And the Buddha talks about sickness, old age, death, getting what we don't want. Not getting what we want, you know, the ups and downs, the endless changing that goes on within our own minds, within our own emotions, within our life, within the life of the world, this endless impermanence. That nothing is solid or permanent. And that everything is subject to causes and conditions. And yet, the Buddha says, you know, of course, the biggest one is sickness, old age, and death. I mean, that's for human beings, that's really the big one. And yet, like the children in the house, it's like, don't bother me. I'm playing. Don't bother me. I'm enjoying myself. And so many of us, we look on with kind of blank stares when we hear these teachings. We don't like the children, they don't understand the teaching, or they don't see, because they don't, like the children, they don't see the fire burning. They don't smell the smoke. That's burning. And this is so essential. And so this is so much what the Buddha is trying to help us to do, to see the raging fire of impermanence. And to look deeply. There are many analogies that we could use here. We could think about, what's the cause of this fire that's raging uncontrollably in so many parts of our Western states? How many people want to look and see impermanence and cause and effect simply operating here? Right? To those who look, it's so obvious what's going on here. Many of the people, the scientists who study what's going on in our world and our climate, are telling us very clearly, have been telling us for 30 or 40 years, this is what's going on, this is what's going to happen. And yet most people are what? We're too busy with our playthings. We're too busy with our plans. And again, it's not like they're all bad. It's not like toys are bad, you see. It's like in the face of what's occurring in the big picture, to only want to play with our toys and want that to continue on and on, is to miss this fundamental point. When we look deeply, we see. So let me, because I want to talk to you, so that's the Lotus Sutra and the parable of burning house. So this is a very interesting one. From Hakuin. So this anecdote, it says during the Gembun era, 1736 to 1740, a fire broke out at a neighboring post station, neighboring to Hakuin's temple. So he writes, I sent two of my monks and our old servant, Kakuza, to find out what was happening. Kakuza came running back, gasping for breath, and made the following report. There is nothing as terrifying or as hateful as fire. 800 dwellings suddenly reduced to ash. How damaging and destructive it is. So this is hundreds and hundreds of years ago, basically the same thing being reported. And yet, fire also has a trait that I admire. This is what his servant says. So Hakuin asks him, what would that be? And his servant says, it occurred to me, on considering how rapidly fire spreads in the darkness, that if it burned with a black flame, it would destroy many more human lives. And I myself probably would not have returned here alive. It is fortunate that the flames burn so brightly. Even tiny fires, small as a bean or a grain of sand, flicker like stars, and can be seen. Very interesting, isn't it? He says, isn't it wonderful that at least with fire, which is so destructive, it has color? It is light. It can be seen, you see. And because it can be seen, we can do something about it, you see. Wouldn't it be terrible if fire was black, meaning it could not be seen? Only its destructive aftermath would be seen. And I think, and again, Hakuin will refer to that now. But if we look at what's going on in life, our own life, we will see the fire of impermanence burning brightly in everything, in everything. But in a certain way, because without looking deeply or seeing big picture, things in the moment look solid and stable, appear solid and stable, even though they're not, even though that's not really how they are at all. But because they appear that way, the analogy is they're like a fire that is black. Right? We look at our own bodies. Our own bodies are made up of, you know, many, many processes that are all in the process of coming and going, changing, and decaying. Right? That is the truth. And yet, we don't see it. Or we look away from it. Or we're scared of it. Or we're angry at it. Or we despair. We don't want to be reminded, maybe some of you right now don't want to be reminded, that the essential quality of a body, our body, our loved one's body, everybody's body in the world, is to be sick, to grow old, to age, and to die. We don't see that in forests, do we? Forests, trees look so solid when we look at them. They look solid. But we don't see that every tree, every bush, every house has the nature of impermanence. It is just made up of parts. And those parts are made up of more parts. And in the right causes and conditions, well, we see the aftermath. You look at those pictures where there used to be a forest, they show us the pictures. There used to be a forest. There used to be a house. There used to be a town. Gone. See, we didn't see that, you see. Nobody saw that. It was always there. The Buddha said in his three marks of existence, everything has the mark, the stamp of impermanence. And yet, we don't see it. Right? That's what he means when he says, aren't we fortunate that we can see the fire so we can do something about it? Wouldn't it be terrible if you couldn't see the fire and only, saw its results? Because we can see the fire, we can send fire people to try to put it out. We can drop, you know what I mean? It's only because we can see it. But if we didn't see it, you know, these forest fires would just rage and rage and rage and rage until they burn themselves out. So now Hakuin, now he says, so Kakuzawa's words, this is his servant's words about, you know, are we fortunate that fire isn't black? His words set me to thinking. I turned them over and over in my mind. The black fire of impermanence, birth and death, moves like the wind, never ceasing day or night, and consumes us all. Not a single person, young or old, exalted or lowly, priest or layman, wise or foolish, can escape its destructions. Yet, no one is shouting fire. Shouts of fire are never heard. Moreover, the principle of karma, cause and effect, this cause creates that effect. Moreover, the principle of karma is working with perfect clarity before our eyes. And yet, even the most smallest, minor, here we use the word evil, are consumed in this fire. The most frightening thing is that most people remain unaware of this until sooner or later they are completely enveloped in the flames. How truly sad and distressing it is. And then Hakuin shouts, Kakuza, that's the name of his servant. He shouts right at him. Kakuza looks up. And Hakuin says to him, don't say that you've returned here alive and unharmed. Don't you know that you've been burnt to a crisp? Don't you know you're a lump of coal? Kakuza sat with a blank look on his face. I gave another shout, very zen. His blankness only deepened. Yeah. Even Kakuza doesn't get it. He doesn't realize that even though he's so happy that he's alive and well, that he really is a lump of charcoal. Because he also, 100%, have the seeds of impermanence within himself. All of us do. Now, this is kind of heavy duty, I understand that. But yet, if I don't share these teachings with you, then I am committing a malfeasance. I am not being truthful about the truth. And all of us in our own worlds, with others, are not being truthful about what's really happening. It's all so simple. It's right before our eyes. If we look at life, we cannot help notice that birth and death are raging. You know, we cannot help but look at those views of those trees where they were trees and now they're just stumps smoldering, and those empty frames of houses to see, oh, it all looks so solid to me, so permanent, and yet, just like that, nothing. Ash. I mean, it's profound. And why is it occurring? Again, the scientists are telling us why these fires are occurring to such an extent. They're telling us so clearly what's going on. And yet, you know, that's just causes and conditions. Everything changes. Everything changes. And yet, how many of us look at it and see what's going on and are willing to name fire as fire, impermanence as permanent, causes as causes? So, again, most of us are like Kakuza, who were just saying, it's like we see what's going on on the West Coast, but I would say part of us are grateful that it's not happening here, aren't we? Yeah, I mean, nobody would wish that it would be happening here. Or if we have loved ones, I've had several conversations with my Dharma brother, Hogan Bays, who many of you know, who has a center north of Portland and a center in Portland. You know, you know, I'm happy he's alive. And so far, you know, nothing's really threatening their monastery. And as at least a day or so ago, his people in Portland were well, you know. Happy to be alive, happy to be safe. And yet the truth of us, none of us are safe, right? Those of us who live in Florida. You know. It's funny, other times I get emails or calls from Hogan when he hears about the hurricane. You know, how are you doing? And how's everything going? And, you know, are you safe? Is your community safe? And you know, and now I'm calling him and asking him about his community. And yet the truth is, here it is. And it's the same truth. Whether it's the truth of our own, our factor of just humanness, that all of us are right now. The raging fire of impermanence is burning in us. Many of us who are getting older, it's more obvious. some of you who are younger may not be obvious, but yet it's fascinating to me. I mean, you know, I'm 75. My children, actually tomorrow, Ty and Karuna, are turning 40 tomorrow. You know, it's like a big deal. And other people, you know, when they turn 30 or 20, it's like a big deal, you see, that we're aging, that we don't stay the same, that life, it doesn't wait for us. It just keeps unfolding. How does it unfold? Why does it unfold the way it does? Because of causes and conditions. Simple causes and conditions. And so, you know, the Buddha is trying to wake us up to acknowledge the impermanence of life, to acknowledge the permanence of things, and to acknowledge that the whole unfolding is simply nothing else but the unfolding of causes and conditions. The Buddha is trying to awaken us to see that, to look, to not be afraid, and not to be in denial, and just for the moment to put down our plaything. And again, we might go, well, you know, we understand children and their playthings and how they get absorbed in their play and how it's often hard for children to put down their toys when you try them to get them to move to the next thing. They want to keep playing, don't they? They don't see there are other things to be done in life than play. You know, each of us has our toys, the things we play with in life, the things that in the moment give us pleasure or happiness, or at least take up time. And yet, all of this is unfolding within this bigger picture of the raging fire of impermanence. And so the Buddha, he's trying to call us out of this house that is burning around us. You know, the same way I would imagine out west, you know, sirens go off, you know, warning people of the approach of fires. Texts go out and other things go out. Evacuate. We know that in Florida, you know. Evacuate. Batten down the hatches, you know. A storm is coming. Prepare. So this is what the Buddha and the teachers are trying to help us to see. You know, the storm is raging. So it's just a matter of time. Do what we can. But individually, at least, we need to prepare ourselves. We need to wake up. We need to see the truth of what's going on in this world and then not be afraid to look at it very directly, unabashedly. Come out of denial, come out of massaging, and just really see the human condition as it really is, the condition of the world as it really is. And then, supported by the Dharma, which gives us not only a clear understanding of the nature of reality, but gives us a path to, in the midst of this impermanence. This is what Dharma is about. It's not an escape from. It's finding a way in the midst of impermanence, in the midst of the raging fire of impermanence, in the midst of the unfolding of causes and conditions, many of which have been set in place for decades, if not centuries, and are just moving through like a fire. Karma also is like a fire. It just moves through. But just like with fire, you know, one of the things that the fire people do is, you know, they have ways. They have ways of slowing it down. They have ways of protecting. They have ways of perhaps, in the short run, putting it out. But if in the longer run, things don't change, you know, it'll eventually be overwhelming. So we need to wake up. We need to face reality squarely, the reality of our own human condition, the reality of the world, and find a way to give this world help. And we cannot see that if we're either playing with our toys or we ourselves are lost in the world of fear and anger, you know, and despair and indifference, confusion. You know, we have to be very clear-minded, not just for ourselves. Many of us have families. We have friends. We have communities. We have people we care about. Now, again, I'm not preaching. I'm not a preacher, and I'm not an evangelical. I'm not saying, all right, everybody, get out there and preach the Dharma to them. No, I'm not meaning that. And actually, in the Lotus Sutra, that's not what the Buddha is teaching. He's saying, know who you're talking to. This is, in Buddhism, this is called upaya, skillful means. You know who you're talking to. In Buddhism, it's appropriateness and skillfulness. You know who you're talking to. Understand them deeply. Their causes and conditions, who they are. And then the skillfulness is the art, is there a way that I can help them begin to see the fire that's raging? You see, I mean, and there are many fires. it's funny. I mean, for weeks and weeks and weeks, we talked about the fire of the pandemic and the fire of racism and racial injustice. You know what I mean? And this week we're talking about another fire that burns through our society, burns through our world, right? And probably, depending on how long we're together, you know, probably there will be other things that will come front and center. But they're all about the same thing. They're all about the unfolding of causes and conditions, and they're all about impermanence. And again, when we wake up, when we're clear, when we really know Actually, in Zen, it's really the other side. It's like when you know there's another way. Right? A way where we are very clear. And we are intelligent. And we can see a danger. And we can name suffering as suffering. And we can name hate as hate. And we can name love as love. And we can name ignorance as ignorance, and we can name understanding as understanding. You know, when we wake up, then we have a clarity that we can bring into the world and really be of benefit to other people. And even at a deeper level, through our study, through our meditation, when we actually experience that within each of us, within our own minds, there is a Buddha mind, there is an awakened mind that is beyond birth and death, that is beyond permanence and impermanence. That will give us a kind of fearlessness in the face. We won't be intimidated by impermanence. We won't be intimidated by change. We will understand that this is just the nature of things. And we'll be able to be, you know, like the Buddha and like the other great teachers, you know, we'll be able to help other people. And again, I'm not suggesting that we help other people by, you know, raising the banner of Buddhism. because one can, you know, most importantly, one can be a Buddhist without anybody knowing we're Buddhists. Because a Buddhist is somebody who is living an awakened life, who's living a compassionate life, who's living a life of intelligence and understanding, right? Who wants to help other people. So, I mean, we don't, you know, the Buddha offered his, the Buddha didn't give a discourse to his children on impermanence and the nature of fires, did he? He saved that for when they were out, you see. And then there's another whole part of the parable when the kids are out. But in the short run, there's only one issue. How do I get them to pay attention and get them out? Right? In the beginning, the father used reason, didn't he? Reason didn't work with the kids. He pointed things out. Can't you see what's going on? That didn't work for them, right? So intelligence and all the kind of clarity we might use with certain adults didn't work with the kids. So we thought, you know, I just gotta get their attention. You know, what's gonna motivate them to wanna get out? You see, and that's creative, and that you know, that has to do with every generation, every person. You know, how do we get them to see it? You know, if they can. You know, we don't know, do we? You know, we don't know how this whole world is going to play out, do we? You know, sort of like. What is that phrase, you know, hope for the best, expect the worst? When you hope for the best and expect the worst, it doesn't matter what happens, right? You're okay with everything. If things go wonderfully, wonderful. If things go terribly, well, that's what happens in this world of impermanence and causes and conditions. And so in the face of all this, you know, these teachings, you know, that we've learned, you know, learning how to dwell happily in the present moment. Learning how to cultivate a place within ourselves, within our own mind, that has some degree of stability and clarity and groundedness. To cultivate a loving, compassionate heart. These practices that we do all of a sudden seem very relevant. Right? They give us, as you know, they give us a path forward in this life. Because we cannot control the unfolding of the world. and we cannot control the unfolding of sentient beings. But like the Buddha, we can do our best to help, to intervene where we can. And that's wonderful that each of us have that possibility. Everybody on this call has that possibility. There are people in our life, family, friends, colleagues, that we can be of help to. Society, the world, you know, how do you wake people up? It's a challenge, you know, it's a creative challenge. I think I mentioned, and I'm sure not the only, other people said it, you know, it was just very interesting. You know, in terms of change, you know, societal change, you know, is always, oh, you know, we can't possibly, you know, give up our fossil fuels. We can't, Americans will never change their lifestyle. You know, they'll never, or it's too expensive, right? But all of a sudden, when a pandemic hits and people's lives are threatened, all of a sudden there's trillions of dollars available, right? All of a sudden, you know, of course, we see what's happening. For causes and conditions, you know, all of a sudden, you know, the whole society just stopped. It was delightful for, I forget how long, driving around Tampa during rush hour. Nobody was on 275, right? It was quite delightful. I'd never seen so many birds at the bird feeder. I mean, I think around the world, right, you know, air quality changed. Just like that. But I think it's something with the nature of most human beings. It takes something so viscerally to wake them up. It has to affect them directly. They're like the children. Right? You try to point things out. You try to be intelligent. You try to be rational. You try to get them to see sort of the obvious, but they don't see it. So it could be that for many of our family members, it will only be when it really gets visceral or, you know, very obviously painful or affects them, you know, like what's happening now, as we see as millions and millions of people now in the world are being affected by these significant changes in climate, you know, that people develop the will to change. And you can see when they develop the will, it's quite simple. And it's really no different than us, right? All of us are like the world. We live our lives. We have our ups and downs. We have our happinesses and we have our sufferings. We have our fears and our angers and our disappointment. You know, we have all this. You know, we have our painful memories of childhood. You know, we have all this stuff. And we think it's normal. We call it life. And then at some point, we give it a different label. We call it suffering. And we realize we don't have to suffer. We encounter the Dharma. We don't have to suffer. It's all just causes and conditions. Causes and conditions can be changed. Why? Because of impermanence. Nothing is solid. Nothing is stable. So therefore, if I start changing the causes and conditions of my life will be different. You know, but for many of us, even to today, We don't see our life clearly. We don't see our life situation clearly. We don't label things as they really are. And so, you know, many of us are still, you know, where we are very good at pointing other people's childishness. Other people's delusions, other people's attachment to their things, other people's ignorance or in denial. You know, we're very good at seeing other people, but some of us still have these things in our own life, and we still haven't really look deeply. And again, you know, I hope this makes you happy. This is a message of hope. This is a message of goodness. This is a message of that all of us have this capacity to bring forward within each of us everything that is good. It is within the reach of all of us. So it's a very optimistic message, the Dharma. But again, if we don't see the fires, if we don't see the operation of causes and conditions, then we'll never be able to act intelligently in the face of what's going on, whether our own condition, our own personal condition, the condition of our loved ones and family and friends, and the life of the world. Yeah, so Hakuin shouts at Kagusa. Kagusa. Don't say that you have returned here alive and unharmed. Don't you see you've been burnt to a crisp, that you're a lump of charcoal? We have to see the reality of our life. You know, in Buddhism, we do strange things. You know, we meditate on our own death. You know, we visualize ourselves, dead, dying. Inwardly, we lay down on the floor and we imagine that life, what that's going to be like. And we just take leave of our whole body, and then we imagine taking leave of our loved ones and our friends, and we imagine taking leave of all our possessions and our reputation and our past and our, you know, we imagine that. That's our way of coming to terms with the reality of impermanence. When you do that, and then you come out of that and you realize you're still alive, you know, you realize how precious every moment is. But you know that, I mean, everyone, our children, our parents, our loved ones, all of them, we should visualize them as dead, dying. Because that is the truth. And when we do that, it makes every moment with them precious, meaningful. Because why? Because you know, we've turned on the light, we see the fire of impermanence burning. It's no longer black. And I assure you, it will make all your relationships and all your days much more meaningful. You won't sweat the small stuff. You won't be bothered by the small stuff, the petty stuff, the ego stuff. All the stuff that seems to consume us. Because the truth is, we are alive, and they are alive. And the world is still here right now. And we have an opportunity, both personally, interpersonally, societally, you know, to be like the Buddha, to point out what's going on, and to show there is another way. So enough for Fred. We have a few minutes, not too many. Are there any questions? And again, please chat them in. Angie is on the chat line. Again, so we don't have too long. And please remember, I think I said it, but if I didn't, when Sangha ends around noon, there'll be a 5-minute break. And then everyone's invited to come back and to be put into small groups. It's sort of like here usually after Sangha, we have tea where members can get together face to face. So this is like a virtual tea. I think people can stay on for, I think, up to 30 minutes, but each group, can do what they want. So please remember that's going to occur 5 minutes after Sangha ends. So again, any questions? Any challenges? It's all good.
What did you say was best, Denise?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
They both got the same.
You have a preference?
And remember, if you do want to you have to press the chat function down at the bottom of the screen. So good. If there are no questions, why don't we do this for the next 5 minutes? You've heard a lot of Dharma today. Just close your eyes a moment. What does it mean to you? The Buddha says, hear the teaching, reflect, and then bring it into your life. Only if after reflection. Has what I've shared today of the Dharma's teaching, does that make sense to you? Does it seem rational? Is it a fairly correct perception of this life? And if it does meet the test of rationality, of your own intelligence, then what are the implications for each of us for our life, how we lead our life, how we relate, what we do, what we don't do? So let's all just take a moment and just reflect, which is a kind of meditation, analytical meditation. We're using our good mind to think clearly on this matter, and we're concentrated. We're not thinking about what we're going to do later or what happened. We're really, what are the implications of this teaching from the Fire Sermon, from the Lotus Sutra, from Zen Master Hakuin? Are you aware of the fire? Do you smell the smoke? And if you do, what can we do, both personally, which is where we begin, our own personal transformation, interpersonally, our relationships, and societally? reflect on the teachings received is like chewing. When we put the spoon in our mouth, we have the food in our mouth and we have to chew it so it is digestible. So this reflecting is digesting. And then when it's digested, then it has the capacity to nourish us, become part of our body, and we can act. We can be energized. So again, we digest by reflecting. Does this make sense to me, these teachings? Are they rational? Do they reflect life? Do they correlate with my own experience? And if they do, then what are the implications for my life, for my activities? You know, just don't be afraid. You know, then you decide what you're going to do. But first, we have to go through a process in our mind, and sometimes we skip that process so it doesn't stick, so to speak. The more reflection there is, the more way we just chew on it, the better chance that the food will be digested and we will get the nutrition from it. Angie wants to get one question in here. What's the question, Angie?
You close the door when there's too much fire?
How do you close the door when there's too much fire? You know, what does that mean? The fire is always burning. We just don't see it. The idea of too much is in the realm of the world of doing. In the world of being, there's no such thing as too much. As practitioners of Dharma, as practitioners of meditators, we are cultivating intrinsically our capacity to be. When we live from a place of being and not doing, and whatever is occurring, we're just being with. Whatever it is. And that's freedom. Because being is always available to us. It is the self that stands outside of life. that posits things like, this is too much. From the place of being, there's just being. Whatever it is. Whatever ways it goes. In the world of doing, there's things to be done. There's fires to be put out. But in the world of being, it's all the same. It's like big picture, you see. It's like, you know, the drama of the fires, you know, are so inconsequential in the universe. Inconsequential, you know, the world will just regenerate. The planet will regenerate. It'll do what it does, as it's always done, as it goes through ages. That's big picture. You know, we're the ones who are, you know, so disturbed by these changes. I mean, as we should be, because this is the world we live in, and our children, our grandchildren, right? But from the planet, you know, it will take care of itself. It has had many ages. Ice and fire. It will be fine. We don't need to worry. Because the planet isn't a place of being. It just is. It just responds to causes and conditions. And so I think it's important when you feel overwhelmed, as this person may feel, that you just put it down. You know, I think that thing I mentioned the other week from Thich Nhat Hanh, when he was, you know, very overwhelmed in the 60s and 70s, you know, with what was going on in Vietnam and the suffering and all the things, the information, the letters from his disciples and students. He said, you know, I just had to put it down. And he said, you know, when I looked at the sky and the clouds, it wasn't because I didn't care about what was going on in Vietnam. It's just, you know, I needed that so I could be with the situation of the people in Vietnam. You know, we need being. Luckily, we don't have to always look at the sky or go to the beach. We want to find that within ourselves, within our meditation, within our own awareness. We can find that place of spacious being that is always available to us and can always regenerate us, always renew us. It's always here. And especially when external conditions become more difficult, it becomes even more important, more essential that we cultivate being. So anyway, thank you very much. I know this was kind of a deep talk this morning, but sometimes that's, you know, the world is burning. You know, we can't keep playing all the time. Thank you, everyone.